You're listening to Robert Greenfield. This is KBOO Community Radio, KBOO Portland. We're at 90.7 FM here in the city, 91.9 FM in Hood River, 104.3 FM in Philomath. So Owsley gets outed as the source of LSD, and that's the end of LA for them for right now.
That's right. They go back up to Berkeley, and now he's got some money, right? And he starts living, even now, in the most unimaginable way possible. He's kind of like a king, ensconced in this incredibly eccentric cottage. He has a pet owl, okay? People come to him to pay tribute, but he's still with the dead. He's still doing sound. He's still their guy. And then when they move to Rancho Olampali in Marin, Bear is in Berkeley. They've lived with Bear. I mean, the great line is Phil Lesh, when they asked him why there was a split with Bear, he said, well, we got tired of living with Superman.
Yep.
Fair enough, okay? So Owsley, who's the soul of generosity, where they're concerned, he bought all their equipment. They want new equipment. His stuff is too heavy. He takes their equipment, donates it to the Straight Theater on Haight Street, buys them new equipment, you know, not getting any of this money back. And so now there's kind of a separation, and he more or less moves into full-time making LSD. And to just proceed through this, he's come up with a new batch that he synthesized somewhere in the East Bay, and he's driving into San Francisco with it. He sees a poster for The Human Being in Golden Gate Park in January 1967, incredibly iconic event. And if you've seen the poster, which is pretty famous as well, there's a bolt of lightning coming across the top, and Bear says, hey, we got to call this stuff white lightning. So that's what people are tripping on. At this incredible, you know, congregation of Jefferson Airplane, Grateful Dead, Timothy Leary, first appearance on the West Coast, Allen Ginsberg, Suzuki Roshi, on and on. Everybody's there. The culture is that small that everybody is there. And so now Owsley, he doesn't let anyone take his photograph. Meanwhile, the dead are still coming to his cottage in Berkeley. He's got all the sound equipment. They can do looping there. He's still a huge influence on the way they're making their music. And you know, when he records their concerts, he records them for himself. He wants to hear what the sound was like during the show and keeping what he called a sonic diary. But they start listening to themselves, and sometimes they don't sound that good. And Owsley is insane about perfection. He's an insane perfectionist, and he pushes them to perform to a level that will sound incredible when he records it. And then the next iconic event is he hangs out with Mama Cass in L.A., who has already taken White Lightning to England and given it to the Beatles in a bottle, okay? And he promises her that there'll be enough acid to make Monterey Pop a success. They go to Denver. They synthesize a whole new batch. This comes to be known as Monterey Purple. So all the acid, pretty much, at Monterey Pop is Owsley's. Pete Townsend, who takes some, and he says about Owsley that he was like the king's taster. Whatever he offered you, he took some himself. He must have had the most extraordinary liver. The acid was so powerful that Townsend didn't trip again for 18 years. Mm-hmm. So many of the performers are loaded on Bear's acid. A lot of the crowd is, you know. The lighting in the movie is because the stage crew gets stoned. They think they're taking one thing, but it's the acid. Three nights later in San Francisco, Bear walks over to Hendrix. They smoke DMT together. Bear turns him on to acid. He takes him into a room and records him by himself. It's incredible. Hendrix asks to see the cassette. Bear gives it to him. He's standing in front of a fireplace. Hendrix throws the cassette in the fire. It burns. There's no record of this extraordinary performance. And I thought, well, you know what? This story can't be true. It's just like, you know, this acid fantasy. And if you listen to Hendrix 8 or 9 months later at the BBC sessions, forgive me, I think he's playing Day Tripper. I'm not sure.
But I think that's what it says, yeah.
You can hear him call out, oh, Owsley, can you hear me now?
So that incident was Hendrix's first exposure to LSD?
No, absolutely not.
Okay, I didn't think so.
No, but the point being is like Bear walks over to him backstage at Fillmore West smoking DMT, which he gives Hendrix to smoke. And I'm sure in that room they were dosed and doing everything that you can imagine. Again, it's not that people haven't taken LSD before. they haven't taken Owsley.
Owsley, right.
I mean, the pranksters immediately get rid of their guy once Kesey has taken Owsley's stuff, you know?
Yeah, and let's jump around just a little bit. Yeah. I mean, there's a ton of stuff we're not going to be able to talk about, and you know, it's possible we don't even get to the wall of sound, but we'll see.
Okay.
But a couple of things that I think are really interesting are, well, first there's Owsley meeting Kesey at the party.
Thank you. Yeah, I love it.
October 1965. Kesey has no idea who Owsley is, and Owsley figures everybody's supposed to know him.
Oh, see, this is what's really interesting, is that Owsley doesn't want anybody to take his photograph, but he wants people to know who he is. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an incredible position. He's always coming on to women saying, "Hi, I'm Owsley." You know, like, "Oh, do you know who I am? You know, I'm somebody." Listen, Owsley was a small human being, very powerful and compact, but not big. Kesey was a wrestler, a huge, iconic Captain America. And Owsley going, "Hi, I'm Owsley." And Kesey looks at him like, "Yeah? So what? You know, who cares?" Then he takes the stuff. Then Owsley becomes a regular at La Honda, the house at La Honda. He's there the night that the pranksters welcome the Hells Angels. Owsley turns on the Hells Angels. The Hells Angels begin selling Owsley. I mean, Owsley basically brings the Hells Angels into the counterculture with the traumatic result, in the end, being Ultima.
Although Hunter Thompson feels as though he was responsible for bringing them there as well, they can share the responsibility,
you know,
well, I suppose.
You know, physically, you're not wrong. Hunter was there that night. Tom Wolfe was there that night. But the reason they stuck around was because not only were they getting high on Owsley acid, they were making money by selling it on the street.
And so then a couple of months later, although I'm sure that, you know, the Grateful Dead were at that party, it wasn't a concert, and they weren't exactly the Grateful Dead even at that point.
No.
But a couple of months later, they are the Grateful Dead, and Owsley makes it to the Muir Beach acid test, which is at the very, very beginning of your book. And I've read about this story more than once before, but I still laughed out loud.
Thank you.
At like, maybe it was like the third paragraph, because I can just picture it. There's this guy who's clearly driving everybody crazy.
Everybody.
And nobody is willing to do anything about it because...
Well, it's an acid test, man. You know, it's nobody has the power. The only way to have the power is to give the power away. I mean, I've been through all those games with those people, and they were so brilliant at all of it. You know, your point is well taken. This is the life-changing moment for Owsley. He goes from being this misfit, this rebel without a cause, this classic 50s figure who doesn't fit anywhere in American society, to having this mega... He freaks out during the Prankster's sound interval when they're doing this horrible screech, all kinds of stuff. The Dead have already played at that point. And what's crazy or brilliant, his first reaction is, this band is going to be bigger than the Beatles.
And I'm going to be part of it.
And I'm going to get on the bus.
Yep.
Yeah.
Instantly.
And a couple nights later, he goes to the Fillmore. And it's that same thing. He sees Phil. I'm Owsley. And, you know, Phil says, you know, I've known you through many ages. Yes, and through many more to come. And right away, they're on a level that's outside the planet. And he's in. He's part of the, you know, he's part of the group. And he's giving them as much Owsley acid as they want. He's paying for their stuff. And, I mean, where would, none of these shows would have been recorded without him, okay?
Well, and honestly, the Grateful Dead would not be what they became without him.
Well, I'm really happy to get into this with you. Let's go another step.
Yeah.
He flashes on Rock Scully. And I knew Rock for a long time. He was a really sweet human being, you know. Rock is doing shows at Longshoreman's Hall in San Francisco. And Owsley flashes on him. He goes to Rock's house. He gets him stoned on DMT. Rock, like, leaves the planet for 20 minutes. And then when he comes back down, Owsley basically says to him, well, you know, you've been putting on these shows, which means you got to rip off the musicians so you can make more money. You need to manage the musicians so they can... He brings Rock Scully and Danny, why am I blanking?
Rifkin.
Yeah, he brings in Rifkin, and Rock is the lead guy in this now. They go to L.A. with the Dead and Owsley, And as Owsley, and Bayer was really proud of this, when they left San Francisco, and I'm going to make you laugh, their price was like $75 a show, you know? But once they go to L.A., all these people, the first Deadheads, where's the band? How come the Dead aren't here? What's going on, man? There's no Grateful Dead? And so the promoters keep calling, and Rock was a really smart guy and a really good businessman. Price keeps going up, you know, mm-hmm. maybe it got to $350, you know what I mean? And there was more, a few of them to pay. So when they come back, the move, which seemed, you know, so stupid, actually helped them. Owsley has brought them a manager, and by them going in exile, he's made them in demand. They come back, they start playing gigs everywhere. And they're not acid tests. You have to pay to get in.
And they really just sort of never turned back from that. They never looked back.
That's exactly right. That's really well said. From that point on, it's all straightforward, not making money, straightforward making music, playing. You know, listen, when I went through this, and, you know, a lot of my other experience has been with the Rolling Stones. I've written 3 books about them. I was on tour with them twice. So I've always said to everybody who asked me that, say what you will about the Stones. I mean, they began in 64. They played every night, you know, traveling from church hall to, you know, this is a band that learned how to play and lived on the road. Grateful Dead are absolutely in the same category. I mean, when you look at how much they were playing back then, when it wasn't that easy to travel, you know, and they weren't on a private plane, man, and they were missing planes, and they were incredibly disorganized, and many of the concerts were chaotic disasters, and they unplugged and walk off. They never stopped doing gigs, and they haven't yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and anyone who listens to, you know, recordings from later 60s, early 70s, invariably, especially if you've got one of those recordings where people haven't cut all the banter in between songs out,
right.
Invariably you hear things like, hey, Bear,
right.
Bear, this isn't working up here. Bear,
it's so great that you say that because, and now we can account for the name change, which is after he gets busted and, you know, eventually wound up going to prison, did 2 years of a 3-year bit in federal penitentiary. The Dead came to visit him and played inside Terminal Island.
Yep, it's a good show, too.
They didn't search the road cases, and everybody was tripping, neither here nor there, is that Owsley says to them, look, man, you know, I'm kind of hot now. Whenever something went wrong, you're exactly right. They'd be screaming Owsley. He said, from now on, you have to call me Bear. And for those who haven't or will not read the book, I mean, he got the nickname when he was like 13 years old, and mm-hmm. his father sent him to military school, and he was probably the only kid there with a hairy chest. So that's where the name Bear comes from. On many ways, that probably was his spirit animal. Okay.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
We've got just a few minutes left okay. here, and I hate to jump around
ahead,
a lot
jump.
In interviews, but I did mention it, and it's such an important piece of
right.
the Grateful Dead's history that
right.
let's just touch on the Wall of Sound a
right.
little bit.
Let's do that. But let's also say, since we're accounting for what did Bear do for the Grateful Dead? Well, he invented the Steely.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
They needed to ID the road gear when they went to these big festivals. He couldn't tell which crates were the Dead's and, you know, which amps were there. So he saw this thing while he was driving to the warehouse in Nevada one day and said, hey, and he had his friend mock it up, and they sold it for $200 as a letterhead, and there you go, probably along with the tongue, the most famous logo in rock. So that's another
mm-hmm.
thing Bear did.
Yep.
The Wall of Sound. Bear came out of prison. He couldn't deal with the roadies, couldn't deal with the beer and the cocaine, and couldn't deal with the attitude, and so once again, he left the Dead. Then the Dead came to him and said, man, we're playing these big arenas. Nobody can hear what we're doing. We want you to build us a sound system that's going to... Okay. Well, when you give Bear license, you have no idea where it's going to end, and if you look at the book, whether you buy it or not, there's a photograph of the Wall of Sound that, as I say, looks like something out of a science fiction movie. You cannot believe what Bear assembled. And as everybody says, and I'm sure you and your people who listen to your show know better than anybody, they never sounded like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this system was in 1974 with line arrays and each musician controlling his own sound. And it was incredibly impractical. It was incredibly expensive. They had to have two stage sets because it took that long to put it up and take it down. I mean, only the dead would have enabled Bear to do this, and only someone like Bear would have come up with what probably still is, and now it doesn't count anymore because everything's digitized and miniaturized. This is back when everything was a practical, as they say in theater.
Yep.
He came up with the greatest sound system in the history of rock, okay?
Yeah, totally without question. And it also happened to coincide with the first great gasoline crisis. So not only was it nightmarish in all these other ways, it was the most expensive time possible to try all this as far as transportation. Yeah.
Two sets of trucks, two sets of roadies, one going ahead to the next gig so you could tear down the one here, and then that one goes to the gig afterwards. Only the dead. Nobody else would do this.
Well, we're just going to have to leave it there. There is so much more to the book. We haven't touched upon at all Bear's time in the Southern Hemisphere, the end of his life, other accomplishments, etc. But the good thing is that anyone out there can go get their own copy of the book if they want to. And that book is Bear, The Life and Times of Augustus Owsley Stanley III. It is out from St. Martin's Press. And if I'm correct, I think the drop date is today, isn't it?
It was published officially on Tuesday.
Yeah, so there's plenty of places around town where I'm sure you can pick this up, and you can probably even order it online.
Probably so.
Robert Greenfield, thank you so much for taking some time out of your Saturday. Really appreciate you being here to chat a little bit about your latest book.
Well, let me say, this is my great pleasure, and it's especially my great pleasure to talk to someone who knows a lot more about the Grateful Dead than I do.
Well, thank you very much.
You be well.
Bye.
Thank you.
All right. So thank you so much to him. I really enjoyed chatting with him about that. And like I said, there is just so much more in this book. So if you've been interested at all, like I said, you can get your very own copy. Okay. So back to more music from the era of Bear. We're going to stay in L.A. here in 1966. And I guess I didn't back announce everything that I played because the Hey Little One was not from the Watts Acid Test. That is from 225 Sunset Acid Test. So still down in L.A. And we're going to stick with that show just a little while longer. Here is one of the first examples of the Grateful Dead segueing back and forth between tunes in a seamless way.
Yeah. baby, baby, gonna let you go. Thank you.
take me home with you and make me feel all right now. I tell your mother and your papa that I'm a schoolboy too now. Your mother and your papa now that I'm just a schoolboy too. Now take me home with you. Take me home with you.
And again, rough outcut. What are you going to do? That, of course, was Good Morning Little Schoolgirl into You Don't Love Me, back into Good Morning Little Schoolgirl. And that was recorded February 25th. 1966. Again, the Sunset Acid Test down in L.A. And that's the last we're going to hear from that show. And this is from March 10th, 1966.
This every river's a big man, blind-headed woman on the other side. Now she's gone, I don't worry, cause I'm sitting on top of the world.
you got a reputation and no consolation, cause you get on what you pay for now. Yeah, I got some doubt in my mind. That's the reason tied me on a clean step now. Oh, I used to say, when my friend all that, but that's the love was a trying to. But now I'm a wonder now in my mind, is that love I see really you?
What do you see? I said, look, baby, look, look at me and tell me what.
jump in here before I play my last track. So since we got back on music following the Robert Greenfield interview, we heard what? I guess we heard Schoolgirl, You Don't Love Me, Schoolgirl. I think I mentioned that. Sitting on Top of the World was the name of that track. That's Rehearsal. They debuted that song a couple of months after that. And then we heard an unknown Pigpen song. These are from tapes that were just made available in August. And they sound wonderful. And Owsley's collection has a ton more stuff like this that nobody hears because it's not available. But there is a project to preserve Owsley's sonic journals, and you can search for Owsley's sonic journals online to find out more about that. And then we heard just there, You See a Broken Heart, from either March 12th or 19th, either in the studio or at a live performance. We're not really sure. Lists conflict about that. But one thing that they don't conflict about is this last here tune, which I'll play in just moments once I find the date on it, because it's not where I think it is. But in the meantime, I'll mention that if you are interested in seeing some live Grateful Dead music performed, you could do so tonight. Final night of the Al's Den run for the Garcia Birthday Band. And next week, right? Next week. Next Friday, the 25th, at the Blue Room at Cartlandia, you could go see Ramblin' Rose at 9 o'clock. And that's down way south on Southeast 82nd. So there's some opportunities there for you. If you want to get in touch with me or any other Grateful Dead and Friends host, you can do so by emailing kboodeadshow@gmail.com. You can also like our Facebook page, KBO Grateful Dead and Friends. And look at that. I just decided I'm playing something entirely different because I'm running short on time for that track I wanted to play. Thanks for all the calls during the day. Everything we've heard today was recorded live between January 8th and March 25th of 1966. And I promise I will not play any 1966 in 2017 because I did two entire shows related to that year. This year, seemingly appropriate, being the 50th anniversary year and all. So I'm going to go out now with an instrumental track, just a jam from March 25th, 1966, one of the few paying performances the Dead did when they were living down in LA with Owsley. And this is pretty much right toward the end of their time down there. This is from Trooper's Hall. Thank you. that's going to do it today for Unbroken Chain, Music of the Grateful Dead and Friends. My name is Andrew Geller. It's been a pleasure playing music for you, doing the interview there with Robert Greenfield about the new book Bear, all about Owsley Stanley. And as I mentioned, if you would like to contact any of the hosts, you can do so via email, kboodeadshow@gmail.com. We do have a Facebook page. We do not post a ton of stuff. And if you don't currently like it, please take a moment to do so.